Hello, this is John Ivey from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. For the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from the June 28, 2010 issue of Sports Illustrated. Where we begin our first article is entitled Dynasty Beginning or Ending. It has a big picture of Phil Jackson, looks like he's leaving the court after their victory over the Boston Celtics in the NBA World Championship, seventh game. The Lakers beat the Celtics thanks largely to the masterly coaching of Phil Jackson. LA's hopes for another three-peat rest with him too, as Kobe Bryant knows. June Jackson calls them her champagne shoes, the woven espadrille flat she wore at L.A.'s Great Western Forum 19 years ago when she had no idea what she was stepping into. The shoes were christened that night when the Bulls bested the Lakers and her husband collected his first championship as an NBA coach. But instead of buying a new pair, she just kept slipping them on every spring as the bubbly chilled and another title appeared imminent. Through 10 damp celebrations, a move to L.A., even a divorce a decade ago, the shoes remained. Stains told the stories of games won and parties conquered. Last Thursday night after championship number 11, Lakers coach Phil Jackson strode into his private lounge at Staples Center, which is really just a spare locker room with black curtains covering the walls and 10 bar stools scattered about. The room was filled with children and grandchildren, sons and daughters-in-law, pizza boxes and popcorn bowls. One of Jackson's twin sons, Charlie, raised a glass of Moet. "Here's to another one," he said, and June kicked up her champagne shoes. The family began to tick off all the nights they had gathered like this, impromptu reunions across the country and the giddiness that ensued. The time Phil rolled down the window of his car leaving the United Center and yelled at the Chicago sky, "We are the champions!" The time his middle daughter, Chelsea, went swimming with her friends in the fountain at the town square in Deerfield, Illinois. The time they shot pool until morning at the Harbor Room in Playa del Rey, California. They tried to match moments with years, but struggled to find a consensus. There had been, if possible, too many titles. "When we first won, I was 16, Chelsea says. "Now I'm 35. I've spent my entire adult life doing this." In the sports world, it is just the recurring harbinger of summer. Jackson standing in another locker room with another commemorative cap on his head, Chelsea having bent the brim so he doesn't look like a nerd. The scene is reassuring in its familiarity, as if a permanent date on the NBA calendar. His 11th title seemed the stuff of routine. Once again, he had the best team and the best player, and yet at the end of it, it was anything but. The week the playoffs began, Jackson made a decision that would spur the Lakers to Game 7 of the finals. Kobe Bryant would no longer have to practice. He stood in his black sweatsuit next to his coach and rested the ankle, finger, and knee that had bothered him for months. Some assistant coaches worried that the players would lose their timing, since Bryant is the one who handles the ball the most, but Jackson understands better than anyone the value of a superstar at full strength. Bryant erupted for 32 points per game in a second-round sweep of Utah. He averaged 33.7 in the Western Conference Finals against Phoenix. He hit the 30-point threshold three times in the finals against Boston. But with his heart racing in Game 7, his legs finally gave out and Jackson had to find another answer. "I was on E," Bryant said. Jackson's friends liked to joke that he could be in the middle of a tsunami and look no different than he does on the bench in the fourth quarter of a playoff game, sitting perfectly still in his padded orthopedic chair, a twinkle in his eye, a bemused smile across his face, displaying the royalty of a king, says mentor and former coach Bill Fitch. But a finals Game 7 would test even the Dalai Lama's composure. And despite Jackson's unparalleled success in June, last Thursday was the first Game 7 he had coached with a title on the line. That it came against the Celtics, 2 years to the day after they vanquished the Lakers from the finals with a 39-point thrashing, only added to the emotional onslaught. Jackson spent the summer of 2008 in a foul mood, thanks to Boston, even mentioning to a girlfriend and Lakers executive, Jeannie Buss, that the Hall of Fame featured a disproportionate amount of Celtics memorabilia. Jackson is not driven by revenge, but the rivalry was stirring within him. Buss, who is collaborating on a book appropriately titled Laker Girl, was professionally obligated to observe Jackson's behavior in the hours leading up to the game. She caught him the night before scribbling plays on the back of a piece of junk mail. She asked him an innocuous strategic question and was subjected to a 30-minute lecture on the 7 principles of basketball. She brought up Charlie's upcoming summer wedding, and he refused to discuss it. On Thursday morning, Jackson awoke at 6 a.m. and made his signature pancakes, a dish with no fewer than 10 ingredients that he prepared to help him relax. Before shooting around at the Lakers' practice facility, he led the players to a nearly 15-minute meditation in the dark, the longest session of the season, the only sound in the room, the hum of the air conditioner. Courtside seats were fetching more than $50,000. Ratings would be the highest since Game 6 of the 1998 Finals. The word legacy was tossed around like purple confetti. Jackson just wanted his guys to block out the noise. Jackson thought he could count on Bryant, the toughest-minded player in the sport. But Game 7 even got to him. Bryant missed 16 of his first 21 shots. He dropped passes, dribbled off sneakers, clanked one shot off the side of the backboard. Jackson spent timeouts just to slow his star's pulse. After three quarters, the Lakers trailed by only 4 points, and guard Derek Fisher gathered them on the bench. "Take a breath," Fisher said, and if ever there was a moment when a team adopted the personality of its coach, this was it. When the Lakers meditate, Jackson instructs them to breathe the same way, up from the abdomen, out through the nose, back again. "That's how we control our chi," says guard Sasha Vujovic. Bryant did not allow his anxiety to diminish his effort. He grabbed 15 rebounds and drove the lane relentlessly in the last period, making 9 free throws. Bryant was MVP. But he turned over the closer role to forward Ron Artest, whose three-pointer with 1 minute and 1 second remaining pushed the Lakers' lead to 79-73. As the clock ticked down on the 83-79 win, every Laker stood except Jackson. Finally, he rose and ambled toward midcourt, exchanging a few embraces. Usually when a coach wins a title, he can't get an inch of personal space. But the 64-year-old Jackson stood alone for a solid 10 seconds, staring into the upper bowl, savoring what he had wrought. He recognizes, even after 11 of these things, that each one would be his last, could be his last. Jackson said that he'll decide in the coming weeks whether to return to the Lakers. "I think this is it," Chelsea says. "I think he's done now." Really, what is the difference between 11 championships and 12, between 3 three-peats and a fourth? Jackson eclipsed Red Auerbach's record of 9 titles last year. He could walk away on his 2 artificial hips and his bum left knee and be thankful the damage from a career spent in the gym was not worse. This seems like the time, with his contract up and owner Jerry Buss threatening to slice his $12 million salary. "If you asked me last February if I was going to continue to coach, I'd have given you a long look and said, probably not." Those were Jackson's words to this magazine more than 14 years ago, before his second three-peat with the Bulls. He claimed then that he would retire within 2 seasons and go off to another career, possibly in politics. Growing up, he assumed he would be a minister. Friends in college pegged him for a philosophy professor. From his countenance, says Paul Peterson, Jackson's close friend and former teammate at North Dakota, you never know how competitive he really is, how his assistants find his dress shirts drenched with sweat even in the regular season, how it is not enough to beat Jeannie at Scrabble every time they play, he has to double her score. These are the kinds of stories people tell about Bryant and Michael Jordan, not the mild-mannered Zen master, but there is a reason he has always been able to relate to the game's killers. If you want to get Jackson going, ask him about the time in high school that a barnstorming team of former Negro players swung through his hometown of Williston, North Dakota, and he had a double off Satchel Paige. That will lead to a demonstration of how he blocked a shot by Wilt Chamberlain as a rookie with the Knicks. When Jackson left the Lakers after the 2003-2004 season, he rode his motorcycle through Australia and Fiji, gave speeches to CEOs, and pondered how he would spend the next phase of his life. Nothing else appealed to his competitive drive, says Charlie Rosen, Jackson's biographer and former Albany Patroons assistant. That's why many in the Lakers organization believe he will be on the bench again. When Bryant signed his 3-year contract extension in April, he told Jackson, "Don't go nowhere." Kobe reiterated that sentiment last Thursday after winning his 5th title with Jackson. "I'm reticent to use this analysis," Jackson says, "but you talk to guys who come back from the war and they miss being in the war. They go back and reenlist because they miss that total immersion of life." Among coaches, competitiveness is most often associated with ripping off sports coats, cracking clipboards, sleeping in your office, and watching tape until your eyes bleed. Jackson does his work when no one is watching. The Lakers rarely scrimmage. They often drill without a defense. Jackson taking them through the paces of each play in his flip-flops, constantly interrupting to remind whoever has the ball what options are open to him. "It's chess," says guard Jordan Farmar, "not checkers." By the time Jackson gets to the arena for the game, the work is complete, and he does crossword puzzles in an office. The goal is to keep his emotions tucked away for fear they will color his thinking and disrupt the plan he worked so hard to conceive. When Artest made his buzzer beater against the Suns in Game 5 of the Western Conference Finals and the Lakers mobbed him, Jackson rushed off the floor because he didn't want to relish in that energy out there. He refused to get too high. And after a Game 5 loss in the finals to Boston, he refused to get too low. Asked what Jackson told the players when they returned to L.A. for the final 2 games, shooting coach Craig Hodges said, "What are you going to tell a pit bull that's ready to fight? You get the heck out of the way." What separates Jackson are the speeches he doesn't give, the timeouts he doesn't call, the spaces he forces his players to fill on their own. "It's like going to a psychologist," says former Bulls center Will Perdue. "He doesn't give you the answers. He expects you to figure it out for yourself." In Game 3 of the finals, the Lakers gave up the first 6 points in Boston, and guard Shannon Brown stole a glance at Jackson. He could not believe what he saw. Jackson was clapping along with the Celtics fans. "He's a mysterious dude," Brown says, "but the mystery is part of the magic. Because players never know what Jackson is thinking, they have to pay attention. You ever see Lord of the Rings?" says L.A. assistant Chuck Person. "He's Gandalf." Jackson would appreciate that comparison given his taste for adventure. This is a man who lives 10 minutes away from his youngest daughter, Brooke, but refuses to take the same route to her house that he takes home. "It's always about the journey," says Jeannie, or as Brooke's 3-year-old son Jackson puts it, "the twisted way." "When you drive, you drive. When you cook, you cook. When you coach, you coach." Such is the definition of Zen. John Wooden had a different label for it, being in the moment, but the idea was the same. For some reason, Jackson has become easy to caricature, perhaps because of that silly nickname, Zen Master, as if Zen can ever be mastered. It is a state of being, whether active or retired, with 11 championships or with none. Wherever Jackson winds up next season, the pursuit will continue, and he will live in every breath the Lakers take. Well, now, how about baseball? We'll find that on page 55. And this article is entitled, "Second to None," and has a picture of Robinson Cano, the second baseman for the New York Yankees, after hitting a ball and running to first base. Unwanted by many in baseball, even his own Yankees, Robinson Cano has become one of the best hitters in the game. Yankees hitting coach Kevin Long rolls a protective screen to home plate, placing it so that it acts as a wall running along the third base side of the plate and flips baseballs from 20 feet away to Robinson Cano, the Yankees' left-handed hitting second baseman. Long's drill is the equivalent of batting in a phone booth. Cano is blocked from hitting the ball to the opposite field, and he must eliminate the stride or drift into the pitch, the exaggerated swaying of hips. What happens next is the expert opinion of Long. Amazing. It is not just that Cano, given the constraints of the drill and the little stored energy from a baseball flip from 20 feet, launches a ball into the right field seats at Yankee Stadium. It is that he does it repeatedly and with ease. The number of times he hits it out over and over again, and to hit it that far, there aren't many guys who can do that, Long says. Devastation never looks so pretty as it does when Robinson Cano swings a bat. Cano's pass at the baseball is as smooth as the glimmer glass of James Fenimore Cooper's leather stocking tails. Rarely in the history of second baseman has a swing been this magical. At age 27, Cano has become one of the best players in the game and one of the greatest slugging second basemen since Hall of Fame legend Rogers Hornsby more than 80 years ago. Through Sunday, Cano led the major leagues by far in batting average, .367. Nobody was within 27 points of him. Led the American League in hits, 97, and total bases, 164, and ranked behind Miguel Cabrera and Justin Morneau in slugging, 614. Only Fred Dunlap in 1884, Knapp LaJoie, 1901, and Hornsby, seven times in the 20s, slugged 600 as second baseman. They're the kind of stats that call to mind not just Cooper's glimmer glass, but also the eponymous hometown of the author's family. I just said to Yankee scout Vic Motta when Robbie's name came up, maybe one day we'll be in Cooperstown, says Yankee special assistant Gordon Blakely, who with Motta signed Cano out of the Dominican cradle of ballplayers San Pedro de Marquise in 2001. The one element about Cano that is even more inspirational than his stroke is as his story. Cano is a baseball anomaly, the elite player nobody saw coming, not even his own team, especially not the team that turned him down in trades or chose not to sign him, even one team with a scout who was his next-door neighbor. Cano was a slow-footed, free-swinging, .278 hitter in the minor leagues. In the majors, he is a career .312 hitter, one of 18 active .300 hitters with at least 3,000 plate appearances, but a rare one who is far better as being a big leaguer than a minor leaguer. Of those 18 active .300 hitters, all of them had minor league averages within 25 points of their big league average, except for three outliers. Maglio Ordonez, 43 points better as a major leaguer, Matt Holliday, plus 40, and Cano, plus 34. Said Blakely, if you ask people if they thought Robbie Cano was going to be an all-star and maybe the best second baseman in the game, nobody would have told you that, including myself. Jose Cano, Robinson's father, did not underestimate his son's potential, not even from birth. When the elder Cano named him after Jackie Robinson, Jose, who pitched professionally for more than a decade, including six games with the 1989 Astros, was so convinced of his son's talent that when Robinson was a teenager, Jose scared off most major league teams, including Houston, with signing bonus demands in the low six figures. Julio Linares, an Astros scout, was the Cano's next-door neighbor in the Dominican Republic. He said, "Man, we don't give that kind of money here," Robinson recalls. The Red Sox arranged a tryout for Cano, but scheduled it for the same day he happened to be taking a final exam in school. He missed the tryout. The Mets did give Cano a tryout and wanted to sign him, but their scout Eddie Toledo told Jose that the club could not meet his asking price. "I talked to his father and told him, 'Your son is going to be a good player in the major leagues, but I don't have that $250,000 you're asking for,'" recalled Toledo, now a Rays scout. The Yankees in the early years of their modern-day oligarchy didn't blink. They had just won the 2000 World Series, their third straight world championship in fourth in 5 years, and were about to launch their own groundbreaking regional television network. Their attendance had jumped by about a million in the championship run, with another million still to come. Damon Oppenheimer, the Yankees' director of scouting, was in the Dominican Republic that winter when Blakely called him and said, "I've got a guy who's going to be at the field today who I think can really hit. He doesn't run well, so a lot of teams may not be on him." Cano ran 60 yards in about 7.3 seconds. Most teams prefer a middle infielder cover the distance in under 7 seconds. "I wasn't going to pay attention to the time," Oppenheimer says. Gordon was right. He could really hit. Gordon says, "It's going to take some money, but I'd do it." I said, "Yeah, we need to sign him." On January 2, 2001, the Astros signed 35-year-old third baseman Charlie Hayes for $500,000. Hayes would hit 200 with no home runs in what was his last year in baseball. 3 days later, the Mets signed 25-year-old utility infielder Jorge Valencia, a career 1.143 hitter, for $200,000. Valencia would go hitless that season and bat 149 in his 47-game career with the Mets. And on the same day, the Yankees signed 18-year-old Robinson Cano for $150,000. My dad stayed up from 7 until 2 in the morning just to do my contract, Cano recalls. Team just wanted to give me like a $20,000, and my dad was like, come on. That was the one thing about my dad. He would say, I know your talent. I know you. I've been in this game a long time. I'm not going to give you away for free. Cano made such little impact, however, over his first 3 years in the Yankees minor league system, hitting .261, that he was nearly traded 3 times in 3 months in 2004. First, the Yankees offered him to the Rangers in April as the player to be named later in the trade that sent Alfonso Soriano to Texas and brought Alex Rodriguez to New York. Texas said no thanks to Cano and instead took shortstop Joaquin Arias, who has played 72 career games with Texas. In June, while he was in AA, the Yankees moved Cano to third base to display him there for a possible trade with Kansas City. The Yankees offered Cano and catcher Danier Navarro for center fielder Carlos Beltran. The Royals declined and instead traded Beltran to Houston for third baseman Mark Tehin, catcher John Buck, and pitcher Mike Wood. 1 month later after that, New York offered Cano to the Diamondbacks in an attempt to get Randy Johnson. The Diamondbacks passed. 6 months later, Arizona did trade Johnson to the Yankees, but instead of taking Cano, the D-backs took veteran pitcher Javier Vasquez, pitcher Brad Halsley, and Navarro. Meanwhile, the Yankees, not sold on Cano themselves, signed Tony Womack to a 2-year contract to play second base. Womack promptly flopped. 1 month into the 2005 season, the Yankees decided to give Cano a shot as their second baseman. After his first 23 at-bats, he had 2 hits and no walks. Manager Dottori called me into his office, Cano recalls. I thought I got sent down, he said. Robbie, don't worry. Keep swinging. The hits are going to fall for you one day. The next game I had 2 hits, and a week later I was hitting over 300. Cano alternately astounded and confounded the Yankees. In 2006, for instance, he hit 342, won a silver slugger as the league's top-hitting second baseman, and was named an All-Star. But over the next 2 years, his batting average dropped to 306 and then 271. In 2008, the same year New York signed him to a 4-year, $30 million contract, manager Joe Girardi benched Cano for failing to hustle after a ground ball that bounced off the glove of Jason Giambi. The episode confirmed the long-held suspicion of some critics that Cano's smooth style of play lacked proper effort. I talk to Derek Jeter all the time, Cano says. 3 or 4 years ago in Anaheim, during batting practice, he told me, listen, I know you work hard because I know you, and you come to play every day. But you know what? Don't let these people label you as a lazy guy, because I know you're not lazy. But if you let them put that label on you, you can work hard, but you'll still have that label. Man, you know what? I wish people could see how I work. Still, Cano knew that his disappointing 2008 season, in which he mostly batted seventh, called for change. Long flew to the Dominican Republic that December to work with him on his hitting mechanics, pulling the ball, pitch selection, and cutting down his trademark glide in the box, and conditioning. He was kind of soft, kind of big, not lean, Long says. At that time, the kid was a little down and out and not feeling good about himself. And there was a concern among baseball people, you know, this guy's got to turn the corner. Cano bounced back in 2009. And with a 320 season that included a career-best 25 home runs, 13 of which he pulled, though he hit just .207 with runners in scoring position, this year's focus is keeping everything we had and now adding to the package, driving in runs, Long says. We need him more than ever. If anybody is important in our lineup this year, it's Robinson Cano. He's number one. We lost Johnny Damon and Hideki Matsui. We brought in some new pieces, but we had a very big chess piece we could now put in the checkmate position, Cano. The Yankees moved Cano into the fifth spot in the order, behind Rodriguez. He has hit .386 with runners in scoring position. I talked to A-Rod, and I listened, Cano says. He said, "Don't go up there and change your mindset just because there are men in scoring position. If you just try to get any hit, you might get lazy, and you'll see what it does to your swing. Just go up there the same as if you had no one on base. Wait for a pitch you can drive. You know what? It works. If they don't want to pitch to you, just go to first base. You keep your average up, your on-base percentage goes up, everything is going to be better." On June 8th, for instance, Cano batted against Kevin Millwood of Baltimore with a runner in second and went out in the fifth inning of the game. The Yankees led 6-2. Millwood threw him four straight changeups. Cano took them all for balls. "That's the kind of thing where I said, 'Wow, A-Rod was right,'" Cano says. "They were going to pitch to Jorge Posada after me." Says Millwood, "The toughest part about Cano is that he hits the ball in. He hits the ball out. He hits the ball up. He hits the ball down. There's nowhere to go with him. He has no holes. You have to pitch to the guys in front of him, and that's Mark Teixeira and A-Rod. He's always been a good hitter. He's just gotten better." After Cano hit 400 in April, he told Long, "April was no fluke." After he hit 336 in May, he told him, "May was no fluke. He is hitting 377 in June. He is delivering the message month by month, hit by hit, drill by drill, beautiful swing by beautiful swing, not just to his coach, but also to himself. This Robinson Cano is far better than the one who was often went unwanted, and yet not as good as the one yet to come. I don't want people to say, 'Oh, Robbie Cano, he made it to the big leagues.' He says, 'I want to be a great player. I want to follow these guys. A-Rod is already a Hall of Famer, and he works hard. Jeter's already a Hall of Famer, and he works hard. Teixeira has 7 great years. Posada puts up great numbers as a catcher. So I don't want to be just another guy who played with Teixeira, A-Rod, Jeter. No, I play with them, and because of them, I work hard to be like them or even better than them." And finally, let's go to letters, page 12. Young fans, young guns. What an appropriate headline for Joe Sinansky's feature on Nationals phenom Steven Strasburg. What took you so long? June 7th. I'm sure another talented young pitcher from the San Diego area is asking the same question. While Strasburg was warming up in the minors, Reds rookie Mike Leake jumped straight from a stellar college career at Arizona State to a major league mound without even seeing the inside of a minor league ballpark. He is 5-1 and has been instrumental in Cincinnati's surprising success. I hope at some point this season Strasburg and Leake will meet, and Leake will say, "Welcome to the majors. Glad you finally made it." That's from Tony Bosch in Independence, Kentucky. Perfect pitch. I really enjoyed Joe Sinansky's article about Landon Donovan's "Good Isn't Good Enough," June 7. Donovan has stood out to me as a different type of player ever since his early days with the San Jose Earthquakes. I first saw him play when I was 5 or 6. I bleached my hair. I bought his jersey. I wore the number 10, and I even took off my shirt when I scored in my youth league. Now I'm 14, and Donovan has inspired me to always improve my game, even when I think it can't be improved. That's from Matt Whitlock in Lodi, California. For years, SI has given its readers the choice to opt out of receiving the swimsuit issue. Could you please do the same for any future World Cup or soccer issues? That's from Jeff in Littleton, Ohio. Well, we've run out of time for today's reading of Sports Illustrated. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm John Ivey, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. So long till next time.